Live from Radio City, you're listening to Transmissions from a Dying Planet with Adam Gorightly and the Visigoth. It is April 20th, 2010, and to kick off the show, this song lyric was never more apropos. It never rains in California, but girl, let me warn ya, it pours, man, it pours. And of course, this is Adam Gorightly reporting live from the rain-soaked state, and without further ado, let me welcome my co-host, Visigoth, who will introduce you to our first hour's guest. Viz, how's the weather?
Well, I was going to say to you, thankfully, we got a full day of rain about a day or so ago.
You are unmuted.
Thank you. as I was saying, we got a day of rain a day ago. We needed it very badly. We're about 14 inches in deficit still. But I think we're going to wind up getting what you have if that system is as powerful as they say it is. So, and I think our guest is out there in the wonderful rain-soaked state as well. And that would be Doug Hawes. Now, you've heard Doug before with us back in the days of Blog Talk when both Adam and he were talking about, at that time, the very strange world of Tuesday Weld. But now, Doug has just written a piece, a very long article, very comprehensive, substantive, on another fascinating character. In fact, the title of it is The Turner Diaries, The Fascinating World of Jeffrey Dean Turner. We're going to talk about that in this next hour. And Doug, I want to welcome you on. Good to hear from you again.
Good to hear you guys.
Hey, listen, I have to say this now, and I'm saying this very seriously. Reading this story, okay, now it is fascinating. What people are going to have to be sold on is whether it's true or not, and you're going to tell us a lot about that. But you know what Jeffrey reminded me of? He's almost like been everywhere at all the time. And it's like if you think about the device they use in literature called a composite character, like Doctorow in Ragtime, it was the brother who saw, like, was there when Harry Houdini broke out of his cell and saw this happening. And also Little Big Man, if you think about at least the movie with Dustin Hoffman. How could somebody be in so many places at so many key times? And yet we have somebody like that with Jeffrey Dean Turner, don't we?
Right. Yeah, he'll be the first to say that he's lived a charmed life. And he considers it to be part of his mystical calling, which he says is being the widow's son. It's a mystical office within Freemasonry, and he claims he fulfills all the prophetic requirements to be the widow's son. And so anyway, yeah, Jeff is a fascinating character. The one thing you can say about him up front is he's totally sincere. He's not a con man. He's not a snake oil salesman. He's not trying to sell a story by concocting one. He is totally, completely and utterly sincere. So the question is whether, on the other hand, is he completely and utterly delusional? Most people who hear the story think he's whack. They think he's delusional. They think he just sort of has some sort of weird mental disorder, autism related, or who knows what. I've known Jeff for such a long time, though, and seen confirmations for certain of his claims and talked to some of his sources that I, for years now, have believed that the gist of what Jeff claims, the majority of what he claims, is actually accurate.
Adam, let me just ask you, Adam, have you been in Jeff Turner's company?
Yes, I have, and it is indeed an experience. Doug refers to it as the Jeff Turner experience.
Well, I mean, Doug, if people aren't aware of certain societies, and all three of us know that things do go bump in the night, so if somebody would read this and not understand that there are things out there, let's just say that, they could dismiss all this. But like Adam and myself and most people who would listen to either this show or Adam's or mine, they understand these things, so it's not that implausible. And when I would read through these, I was just about ready to say, eh, and then I was like, oh, well, no, that does make sense. Can you at all, I mean, I think you tried to do that before, but can you capsulize him? Is it possible? Is this just one of those lives that by some kind of propitiousness or star-crossed fate has been thrust in this position?
Well, no, there's an actual logic behind why Jeff has had all these remarkable experiences. There are the ones that are just uncanny and unexplainable, but there is a lot of what's happened to Jeff that just makes sense because of his background. And the background that allows a lot of these connections to take place is that Jeff is one of a bunch of people in this country that have some sort of connection to what I call the secret society matrix that's behind the scenes in this country. And the difference with Jeff is he wants to talk about it. And all the others would prefer staying in the shadows. They just don't want people to know about their secret involvements. Now, I'll give you a classic example of this, and it's one of the more fascinating stories. Okay, now Jeff, way back in the 80s, wait, was this like early 90s, started saying that he was connected with people who were involved in the government's time travel program. And he went so far as to say that the 1966 Hollywood television series, The Time Tunnel, was based on the actual Army's time travel program of that day, which was called Operation Kronos. And he said the set of the time travel show, The Time Tunnel, was an exact replica of the time tunnel mechanism located in an underground facility in New Mexico. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so, okay, I can buy that. But then he started saying all this stuff about the song After the Gold Rush by Neil Young was about people who were involved in the time travel program going back in time, going in forward in time, trying to change and prevent the wars, seeing the arrival of the extraterrestrials in the future. And I'm saying, why would Neil Young write such a song? Neil Young's just a pot-smoking hippie rock star, right?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Okay, so that just totally is like, that's whacked. I mean, that's ridiculous. Yeah. Neil Young writing a song called After the Gold Rush that's about time travel programs in the federal government? No way, that's mm-hmm. whacked. Well, then Jeff gradually gave a few more of the details of the story, and then it started making a little more sense. He said that After the Gold Rush is based, Neil Young wrote the song based on some, like, screenplay that a Hollywood actor, Dean Stockwell, wrote. Okay?
Yep.
Now, Dean, you've heard of Dean Stockwell,
right? Oh, absolutely,
right?
Yeah. He was in a bunch with Hopper and them, yeah.
Yeah, he was in one of those sci-fi TV yeah. series a while, like, I don't know which one it was, like Babylon 5. Or
that's
he's
right.
He's had some
mm-hmm.
lead roles in some of those sci-fi shows, right?
That's right.
Well, actually, Neil Young and Dean Stockwell are good friends. And After the Gold Rush is based on a screenplay that Dean Stockwell wrote. It was never made into a movie, but he wrote this screenplay about, I think, time travel. Going back in time and such.
Recorded live.
Adam's at it again. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Doug. Just repeat that, please.
We're okay, good?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Dean Stockwell wrote this screenplay called After the Gold Rush. It was never made into a Hollywood movie, but it's about, like, going back in time travel, kind of a sci-fi story, okay? Now, Jeff says that Dean Stockwell is one of the guys actually behind the scenes that was involved in this time travel program in the 70s, 80s, and such, okay? And so you can, if this is in fact true, you could see like this Hollywood guy who lives a public life of being a Hollywood actor, but it's only 800-mile drive, and you can get access to these underground facilities in New Mexico or Colorado or wherever they are. People usually throw out Area 51, but Jeff Turner is more oriented towards the facility, which is supposedly in Archuleta Mesa near Dulce, New Mexico. And he could just flash his pass and be inside this facility. And it's very easy to conjecture that some of these Hollywood people living in Southern California also participate in some of these black budget programs in the American Southwest. It's not implausible. Anyway, so...
Was his exposure to this, though, Doug, did this have something to do, I mean, would things have been this way had he not been adopted? That was correct. Wasn't it an Air Force couple that adopted him?
Oh, yeah. Let me go back to that. We need to cover that.
Yeah. Okay.
The reason Jeff is part of the secret society matrix is because he was kind of born into it. He was adopted basically at birth. And he claims there's a whole story behind why he was given up for adoption. But he was adopted by Merrill Dean Turner and his wife back in 1954. And Merrill Dean Turner was a career Air Force aviator. He caught the tail end of World War II. He's a B-17 pilot in, like, the last months of the war. In the Korean War, he was a B-47 pilot, and... He flew also in the Vietnam War and was he died. His plane went down in Vietnam in September of 1967. Jeff says that his adoptive father, Merrill Turner, was in fact a member of a military secret society known as the Kalanicki Order, or just the Kalanicks.
What is that based on, Jeff? Doug, I'm sorry, what is that based on?
Jeff says that the Kalanicks is a knighthood order that emerged in the Ukraine way back,
okay,
like 1,000 years ago. The Ukraine used to be the focal point of the first Russian kingdom way back around 990 AD. Vladimir I put together the first Christian Slavic Russian kingdom. It was called, we call it Kievan Rus. And typically Vladimir I is considered a saint in the Kalanick order. So it's some sort of Ukrainian Orthodox religious knighthood order. And somehow it penetrated the United States. And there are people in our armed forces that are members of this knighthood order.
All right, Doug, let me just jump in real quick so we don't get too far away from this. Please hold on to what you were about to say. Did Jeff indicate, or did you find out yourself, or both, that there are secret societies, shall we say, in every branch? Do you know that?
Of the military?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's well known that military Masonic lodges are an important,
right,
component of the armed forces community going way back. And you have Masonic Lodge typically right outside a base, and a good number of your officers and NCOs will be Masonic members. This one fellow I talked to who was based at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, said that Masonry was really big, and especially among the black soldiers. And he didn't like the whole the secret society Masonic stuff. He thought if you needed to join the Masons or another secret society to get ahead in the military and not just advance through your own merits, that was just like not respectable.
Okay.
And he never joined one of the secret societies, the Masons, and he said the Paladins were active there. That's a sister order to the Kalanicki, the Paladins. They're slightly better known.
Is the Kalanicki only Air Force, or is it across all branches?
Supposedly, it's represented in all the branches.
Okay.
Now that's where Jeff's connection to Tiffany comes in. Is because Tiffany's stepfather was a military veteran and also a Kalanicki member. So her stepfather and Jeff's stepfather, because after his adoptive father died in Vietnam, his mother, about a year later, year and a half later, remarried to another man in the same B-47 bomber unit, and she had... You know, her and her husband Merrill had known Richard Truesdale back when they were all stationed at March Air Force Base in the 50s. And so she remarried Richard Truesdale. Well, he later became the Grand Master of the Kalanicki.
Okay. Now, let me, I don't know if this had a bearing on it at all, but at the time that Turner died. I'm assuming that, I mean, that must have caught Jeff at what, like 14 or something like that? Was that tough for him?
It says it was very traumatic, and it said it was especially devastating to his mother. And he was 13 years old when that happened. It was 1967.
All right, now, did that shape him in any way, shape, or form? I mean, did that change things? Or because he really did have, from what I understand from the article, being adopted, he got along very well with his adopted siblings. Is that true?
I don't know how well he got on with the adopted siblings. I just know he constantly has been talking over the years about how authoritarian and even fascistic his adoptive father was and his stepfather. And he was harping on that for years. And that's okay. The critical tool to understand Jeff's psychology of not really being able. He looks like a conformist, but then he won't conform because he won't do the stuff like everyone else, like just go to school, get a job. He's kind of like a beatnik that on the outside looks like a conformist because he's very square looking. You know, he's had the same haircut for 40 years. Whereas very conservative, kind of like normie, conformist clothes left over from like high school prep days or something like that. But he acts like a beatnik, and he kind of seems like he gravitates towards kind of the misfits of society. Like he doesn't have any problem hanging out with long hairs and just talking with them and stuff.
Well, all right, before we go any further, I want to do a little business. We're speaking with Doug Hawes. He's written an article entitled, and a large one at that, The Turner Diaries, The Fascinating World of Jeffrey Dean Turner. It's got photos. And what I'm going to ask you now is, Doug, can you give us ordering information, how people might be able to obtain that?
Well, yes. I am reprinting them. If somebody writes me at this address, I can get you a copy. The address is just care of the Secret History. We call it Secret History.
Mm-hmm.
P.O. Box 1251, San Jose, California, 95108. And you can also reach me at this email address. It's all lowercase. D. Hawes. That's DHAWES 2002@yahoo.com. So if you do wish to request a copy of this edition of Another Mirror, if you sent me like $7, that would cover my costs of shipping and reprinting. Because every time I get a request for these, I have to go down to the Photoshop and reprint these and make copies of the color plates and everything. So about $7 will cover my expenses, more or less.
And is it your wish that I put up that contact information along with the audio so that if people do obviously go there after this, that they can actually find that?
Oh, certainly. Go ahead. And also I should mention that people can write Jeff Turner care of that P.O. Box also. He's very eager to hear from people that are interested in his research and his story, and I will definitely get those letters to him.
And also at this time, let me say that, folks, if you wish to call, make a comment, or ask a question of Doug, you can do so by calling 724-444-7444. Doesn't get any easier than that. And then the caller ID is 75423. You'll be prompted for the rest. And Adam will be manning the phones. I want to jump back real quick because you were kind of giving us the description of Jeff. Did you find that he has some exceptional capabilities or faculties? Is there something special about him?
Well, he's got an incredible memory. I mean, he reads voraciously, and he can tell you to look for some archival source from something you read 20 years ago, and you'll look into it and be able to find something. And his memory is phenomenal, and he's a vast storehouse of information and name. He can name dropped thousands of names of people that were involved in certain things. It's really remarkable. I recommend that people who have the time or ability or just happen to be in California, track him down. Go to the soup kitchen in downtown Santa Cruz, track Jeff Turner down and hang out with him for a couple days, because it's like an experience, and you'll have a paradigm shift in your understanding of the world and how it operates.
Well, you might have just stopped people in their tracks a second, because they're thinking that perhaps Jeff, as you've been describing him, might have been a computer programmer out there or Silicon Valley or something like that. Now all of a sudden you say you can check him out in the soup kitchen. Do you want to explain that? Because people are going to be like,
Okay, well, first of all, Jeff, by his own admission, is a little autistic. And there's a form of autism that I first heard about through Jeff called Asperger syndrome. And it's the most highly functional form of autism, okay? And these people are the sort of nerdy personalities that can memorize thousands of pages of data and information, but they have little or no social skills, okay? Sometimes it's called little professor syndrome, because the person will just be sitting there in a social gathering talking about all the presidents of the United States or, you know, and going on and on and on and on, and people don't know how to shut the poor guy up, and he's talking way too loud, and people are, like, smirking and trying to hide their laughter because the guy's such, you know, kind of geeky. But I'll say one thing, though. Jeff has improved over the years. When I first met him in 1987, he was traumatized. He was, like, very delicate and fragile on some sort of psychological way level. And he's gained more self-confidence over the years, and he's gotten more just ability to dialogue with people. And I've seen him interacting with people, like, backstage at shows and audience where he's appearing before an audience, and he's answering questions, and he's much, much smoother now, and I'm quite impressed at how he's improved. Now, what happened to Jeff is he did not get along with his stepfather, Richard Truesdell, ex-Air Force, Corsair fighter pilot in World War II, and at the time when Jeff was being raised by him, he had left the Air Force, and he was flying for Pan Am. He was a 747 pilot, a captain with with Pan Am, flying 747s all over the world. And Jeff and Richard Truesdell did not get along. And so there were disciplinary problems. And by the time Jeff was 17 years of age, or 16 or 17, the problems had gotten to a head, and Jeff apparently was just no longer cooperating with his stepfather. So his stepfather and his mother decided to send him off to a boarding school for people with emotional and psychological problems and learning disabilities. So Jeff ended up going to this, like, boarding school called Devereaux near Santa Barbara, and I don't know if he even got his GED, but so anyway, he graduates, or I don't know if he graduated. He comes back to the South Bay, and he is working at a series of jobs, just blue-collar jobs, worked in metal shops, furniture factories, plastic factories, just blue-collar work. And at some point, after about 12, 13, 14 years of work, he just could no longer get hired. He would what would happen is they'd hire him, and he would work for like a year or two, and at some point they would just tell him, look, you've been here for 2 years. By this point, you should have total handle on this job, and you should be able to really work faster. But you're still going as slow as you were a year ago. And, you know, have to work at a faster pace, or we're going to have to let you go. So he kept losing jobs after working at each one for maybe a year, maybe 2 years. And at some point in the beginning of the 80s, he decided that he wasn't really employable, and his own family decided to get some sort of attorney to see if he could get on federal disability, which is what happened.
Okay.
So he's on federal disability, and he hasn't worked since around 1980, 82, 83, 84, somewhere around there he stopped working.
Did he ever write any of this down? I mean, has he ever tried to chronicle what he's experienced?
Well, this is a funny thing because it's part of his autism. But every time we're in public and we're talking about Paranoia Magazine or we're talking about Another Mirror at the End of the Road, he'll say, like, here's an article that I wrote. And I'm going like, Jeff, wait a minute. I wrote this article. It's based on your information, but I wrote this article. And he goes, well, it's entirely based on things I told you, so it's really my article. And I'm like, no, he has never sat down and written any substantive article. That is, first of all, he's one of these guys who doesn't like authority. He never sat down and just, like, disciplined himself to learn, like, proper essay writing, how to cross your T's, how to spell correctly. So if he writes something, it's kind of embarrassing because every sentence will have a word that's spelled wrong.
Okay.
You know, real basic words,
yeah.
You know, like just – so his writing is distractive because he spells so poorly.
You know, not that it's a big deal, Doug, but that's why I kind of asked if he had some exceptional capabilities. I'm not – and I cannot speak to this with any kind of experience or authority, but sometimes it's been my – at least – it seems to me that autism or something that someone might be, should I say, inflicted by, turns around and also kind of graces them with something beyond what we all have. And I just didn't know if that were the case with Jeff. It kind of seemed that way to me, but, you know, that's neither here nor there. But that's kind of where I was going with coming from with that statement. So do you want to speak to that at all or –
Oh, sure. Yeah. There's no doubt about it that there's some unique charm and magic about Jeff. I mean, he's just like people that are around him will see that he's like a transparently decent guy, up, honest, sincere. And he has a certain kind of intellectual, spiritual charisma to him that some people can find endearing. And, you know, there's nothing plotting or cunning about Jeff. It's not like some guy that you're wondering about, what is this guy's racket? You know, what's this guy up to? Is this a con that he's pulling on us? You just know right up front that, you know, Jeff is straight up and sincere. So he also has a really incredible gift for creating like a broader vision of, like, what are the cosmic forces at work battling. The way he put it when I first met him was that there was, like, this huge battle between opposing power blocks for control of our country and the world. And one of them he called the Illuminati, or sometimes he would just call it the Druidic Illuminati,
right.
'Cause his whole theory is that the Welds and other Druidic families call the shots in the Illuminati. So he calls it the Druidic Illuminati. And he says they basically control the media, they control the banking system, the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds are aligned with this Illuminati block. And then he says these people are at war with what Mae Brussels is calling, and I agree with her, the World Nazi Network, or we can call it international fascism.
Yeah.
And these people are dominated by the remnant German Nazi leadership, which is now located in South America. So anyway, I'm listening to this stuff when I first meet Jeff at the very end of 87 and then throughout 88, 89, and I'm going like, wow, this stuff makes sense. This kind of makes sense. This paradigm.
Yeah, it does. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I was just fascinated. But then the problem was some of the stuff Jeff was claiming, I'm going, that's way, I don't know if I can buy that. One of his ones was that Paul McCartney had died in a car crash in 1966, and they had replaced Paul McCartney in the Beatle lineup with a lookalike, some guy from who had won a Beatles singing contest in Toronto, Canada, had been, and looked, a dead ringer for Paul McCartney, had been plopped into the band, and the Beatles kept performing as if nothing had happened. And I'm itching my head going like, that's pretty fanciful. I don't know about that one. And then, of course, the After the Gold Rush and Neil Young, right? And I'm like, oh, come on, man. Neil Young is not involved in any time travel. Nah. And there were other ones, too. So I have this, like, bullshit
index or barometer,
like, in the back of my head where I'm like, and I call Jeff on it now, too. I'd like to go, no way, Jeff. Nah, I don't buy that 1 minute. No way. And so I, like, so there's some of stuff, Jeff's stuff, that I'm, like, highly skeptical of. But there's so much believable stuff and so much stuff I consider proven that it's just like he's like a paradigm changer.
Well, here's what I want to do again. I just want to give some ordering information. Then I want to pick up something. I want to be understanding of Adam, who wants to jump in and also give some of his experiences. And I know that you probably want to go somewhere else also, Doug, even if in the last part of the interview you want to address the time travel. But there's something I want to ask as a favor, because this is what hooked me in as soon as I started reading the article. But I want to tell people that we're with Doug Hawes. He is the author of The Turner Diaries. It's not the one some of you folks are thinking about. No, this is The Fascinating World of Jeffrey Dean Turner. Now, the order information was just given, and I'm going to give it real quick, but it'll also be up on a link to the audio. I know it'll be on thinkorbeeaten.com. That's my site. Adam might be putting this up as well on adamgorightly.com. But if you want a copy of this article, replete with color photos, great stuff, you can do that by writing Doug Hawes at P.O. Box 1251, San Jose, California, 95108, 1251. I'll give you the email address also through which you can correspond with Doug, and that would be dhawes, H-A-W-E-S, 2002, at yahoo.com. He's asking $7 just to cover the production and the mailing. And the one thing we didn't talk about last time, Doug, and that is, how would you take payment? Are you going to take Federal Reserve notes or money orders? How do you feel about checks? Can you clear that up for us now?
You know, I'll take cash, check, or money order.
Okay.
Go for checks.
All right. Anything that I left out that you might want to speak to? I know you can also get in touch with Jeffrey Dean Turner through you. Would you want that address, though, as secret history so that you don't necessarily open it up? Is that the idea?
I would just put attention Jeff Turner on the envelope somewhere, any indicator that it's really addressed to Jeff, and I'll just not even open it or just forward it to Jeff, because I send Jeff stuff in the mail not infrequently, so I'll just forward it to him, put it in an envelope, and send it off to Jeff at his address in Santa Cruz.
All right. Now, if you will indulge me, and then I'm going to ask you to indulge Adam, but I will tell you, I mean, when you get to the subhead in the article entitled Jeff's Conspiratorial Cosmology, I mean, my goodness, in
what?
Almost not even two full columns. I mean, you hit all the basic food groups in that one. Holy mackerel, going from the CFR and the Rockefellers through that Nazi network you were talking about. But there's something I would like to ask you about, and it may not be a big thing for you, and that's okay, but I just have to ask you. So many times, I think we come in contact, perhaps briefly, and it doesn't involve all of us, really, or any of us, but I find it's interesting that it pops up, and it has popped up for over now, well over a half century. It's the biggest mystery I think there is on this planet as far as things that are topographical, and that is the fascination with and the kind of obscured history we have about a very strange place called Antarctica. Can you speak to that at all?
Well, that was one of the fascinating things that Jeff got me hooked on early on, because there's a whole plethora of topics he brought up the first year I was hanging out with him. Because I was hanging out with him on a regular basis in Santa Cruz throughout 1988, also 1989. And one of the things he said was that the World Nazi Network is controlled by aging Nazis that relocated in South America after World War II. And that one of their aces in the hole was this secret base in Antarctica on the land which the Nazis claimed in 1938.
Right.
And they called it Neuschwabenland.
Yep.
That's well known, the whole thing about the Nazis going down there in this expedition at the very end of 1938 and claiming a hunk of land. They flew planes over the ice and dropped little swastika flags all over the ice, and they claimed it for Germany. But that's well known.
Yeah.
But the supposed secret history is that throughout World War II, the Nazis continued their interest in this area they had claimed, and they, by U-boat, they were sending teams down here to begin creating some sort of secret base. And the claim is that this secret base not only survived the end of World War II, but that it continues in existence to this very day. And this is what Jeff claimed. He said some of his stuff was, like, pretty wild, though. He said that, like 2 or 3 million people lived at this underground base. And I was like, oh, I could believe maybe 20,000 maybe are in this, you know, incredible underground facility. And they have, like, bionic agriculture. They have geothermal heating and all this stuff. And but they still exist. They're still down there. And he had all sorts of other interesting information. He said that in the 1950s, the Norwegian government took a case to the International Court of Justice in the Netherlands, and they tried to reclaim complete sovereignty over the land that they call Queen Maud Land, and they were quietly rebuffed, supposedly. This is what Jeff said. And he also says that he had talked to in the night, like around the mid 70s or sometime back then, some Navy veteran who was a retired Navy guy. He'd been a Navy frogman, and he said he participated in the Special Forces operation in 1947 to kick the Nazis out of Antarctica. And he told Jeff they got their butts kicked.
Well,
so anyway, this base, according to Jeff, still is down there. Another friend I know says that he has heard from other people that the U.S. Navy patrols that part of the coast, and if you try to approach it, they will turn you away. They won't let anybody approach that part of Antarctica.
Well, I won't dwell on this, but I will say it's things like that. For instance, a couple of years ago, I don't know what precipitated or necessitated it, but suddenly the New York Air Guard wound up flying down in there. And it's like, why is the New York State Air Guard going down there? But remember, too, that in 1984, in the book Inside a Book, the one that was written by Winston Smith, Orwell, obviously, through Smith, there is a paragraph solid set, and Orwell just dings things off that have happened since he wrote that book in the 1940s. And one of the interesting things he mentions in there, he said, and the lost islands of Antarctica. And I mean, you know, that just fuels my curiosity about that place. And so when I saw that, I was, you know, of course, that compelled me. That's just one of the little, you know, bailiwicks that I enjoy taking a look at. But something is going on down there, and for so many people to want to be scrapping over that, it's kind of interesting. If nothing's going on down there and it's as barren as it's supposed to be, and my feeling is sometimes is what we see above the surface may be coming from below the surface. I'll let it go at that. But thanks for indulging me on that. And Adam, I know that you've had some experiences, and we haven't talked about that yet. Could you jump in at this time?
Well, I want to bring the listeners' attention to different articles I've written and Doug have written. I write about the experiences I've had with Jeff Turner if people want to learn more. The first thing I wrote, I believe, was called Tuesday Weld is Watching You, The Shocking Truth of Occult Secret Societies in Santa Cruz, and that was originally in Steam Shovel Press, then reprinted in my book, The Beast of Adam Go Rightly. Then Doug and I co-authored a piece in Paranoia magazine called Tuesday Weld, Psychedelic Illuminati Conspiracy, which was later reprinted, kind of the edited version with some other stuff thrown in, and it appeared in book called Secret and Suppressed, an anthology published by Farrell House, and of course this recent article Doug mentioned in another Mirror magazine. So those are some of the sources for finding out more about Jeff Turner. Hey, Doug, a little interesting thing happened here a few minutes ago. Viz and I have a little secret squirrel chat room on the internet where we'll talk to each other during the course of the show. Nobody else really knows this address, or so I thought, and I'm not making this up. Viz can confirm this. As we were chatting with each other, a third person popped up in this chat room by the name of Alyssa. What do you think of that? I'm not bullshitting you.
Are you serious?
Yes.
I am dead serious. Viz, can you confirm that?
Yeah, not spelled the same way, but obviously from whatever I know, the name, you know, dinged in my head. And, yeah, it was A-L-E-S-Y-A. Not the same spelling, but close enough.
Yeah.
Very interesting.
We are not alone.
Hey, maybe we'll get into Alyssa, but first I want to ask, pass on a question we had in our the chat room we have at TalkShoe, and someone posed the question, ask him, being you, Doug, about the Santa Cruz ops work that Jeff was involved with, after which he melted down, and the person asking this question adds, is this too personal?
After which Jeff melted down? Or
yeah.
What does the reference melting down refer to?
Well, I'm not sure. I thought you would know. Perhaps he didn't melt down.
Well, the thing about Jeff is he says that when he was working at a furniture factory in Santa Clara, back in the mid-70s, this was right after his high school years, and he had known a young lady at a high school in Cupertino, California, who the rumors were was involved in like some sort of like cult activity, and like this crowd at this high school were involved in some like black satanic stuff, and this was the rumor. And so anyway, at this furniture factory, he was approached by a fellow, a Vietnam veteran, a Marine Corps veteran, who basically gradually took Jeff under his wing and said, hey, we need your help because we are actually tracking this person, and she's come to our attention, and her people are doing some pretty dark stuff. Okay, so it turned out that Jeff got pulled into a network in the Bay Area. Jeff claims was CIA connected. And the reason they were interested in, we'll call her Christy, was because her people, she had some sort of like lust for power, or her backers wanted to use her, is another way of looking at it, to penetrate the defense industry. Because the Silicon Valley in the 70s had a lot of the cutting edge defense contracts. They were doing a lot of the electronic research and advanced guidance systems and all sorts of military applications. So her people, they began to pick up that her people were trying to gain access to information to some of these contractors like Lockheed Martin and I don't know, some of the other contractors working in the Silicon Valley. And it got to the, came to the attention of the federal government, and the Fed started trying to track her activities and her followers' activities. And so Jeff, for about a 10-year period, had some fellow he was reporting to with whatever information he could come up with. So when I met Jeff in 1987, the very, very first thing he told me, the very, very first thing was, he said, I'm involved in tracking the activities of a locally based cult priestess who's working directly with a known KGB agent. Okay? And the KGB guy was her Ukrainian boyfriend, Michael Snedetsky, and he was a former Soviet Spetsnaz soldier. That's basically their special forces in those days, the Spetsnaz soldiers. And he had defected to the West. Officially, he had defected to the West, but he actually had maintained his linkages to the KGB. And he was like a right-hand lieutenant to Christie in this period of time. So anyway, she had like a hunger for power, and she was playing in some really dark, heavy political espionage-related stuff. So it wasn't just cult activity in the Santa Cruz Mountains. It also had political aspects, and Jeff was involved with that, and that's the context in which I knew him at first. And he had a couple of people on the streets of Santa Cruz he would always ask, like, so did you come up with any new information? Did you run into that person at the soup kitchen? Did you see them at the library? You know, and this kind of stuff. And there's about four or five of these guys.
Well, now that you mentioned Christy, I just want to know, do you want to speak? I mean, there seems to be three females that are prominent in this story. And that would
up
be...
Up to four now. The original story, when I first heard it, was Weld and Christy. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in the spring of '88, add Tiffany, and now it's Lisa, or more recently.
All right. Well, do you want to backtrack through that? And since we might have been contacted by Alyssa, or that's an extremely interesting coincidence.
That is a very
which I don't believe in.
I wonder what that's about. Like, it's like, I'm warning you.
So
I'm warning you. You know.
It's up to you. Do you want to hit that at all, or?
Well, Weld is the most interesting in a lot of ways, because there's stuff you can find out about Weld. You know, there's her movies are out there, and she is a public figure, and there are songs that seem to have references to her. The most shocking one is probably some of the Beatles songs, like I Am the Walrus has Tuesday references. Another one is She Came In Through the Bathroom Window has a Tuesday reference, and Ruby Tuesday by the Rolling Stones. So there's a lot of interesting leads, old obscure magazine articles long out of print have interesting references to Tuesday.
Oh, excuse the salacious reference here, but in Lady Madonna, is Tuesday the one that is never ending?
You know, that might be a Tuesday Weld reference as well. What? It goes Monday morning, Tuesday, Wednesday, and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like,
I know. But I could speak to her prowess in the sack, but never mind. I'm going to try to picture this quickly, but I'm not going to try to fake it. Jeff, did you happen to mention the movie that is the most telling, perhaps, about things that go bump in the night with Tuesday Weld? Did you mention one?
Well, A Safe Place is the one that is the most autobiographical, and it's long been unavailable, and it's sort of resurfacing more recently, and I finally got a chance to see it not long ago. It has Orson Welles, Jack Nicholson in an early role. Before he became a big star, and Tuesday Weld is the lead, and it's set in Manhattan in Central Park, and it's got some very interesting stuff, like the character that Tuesday Weld plays reminisces about when she was a little girl and how she could actually fly and levitate, and she tells some of her adventures, like, and how amazed she was as a little girl to see that she could do this, and it's like, the way Jeff would put it is this movie was way, way too revealing, and that's why they kind of iced it.
What is
that's
the title?
That's exactly what she was like when she was a little girl.
Do you have the title on that?
It's called A Safe Place, and it's that's from it. 1972, I believe, and it has Orson Welles, Jack Nicholson, and Tuesday Weld.
Boy, and you say that's pretty much been out of, so to speak, print, if you were to try to get it through a DVD or such, right?
Well, it's sort of like a 70s art
cult movie
genre film, and it's not the sort of film that it kind of bombed in the theaters and the critics panned it, and it's just not the sort of movie that you can show on Channel 5 or, you know, whatever, you know, at late night TV. It's just boring for most people. But to, like, a college crowd who's intellectually minded, it's a sort of film that they might find interesting.
The reason I'm saying I didn't know who had done it, so that just came up again. So I thought you made a reference to it, and somebody else did, and it just seemed, you know, I'd never even heard of this. Then all of a sudden, bang, as things happen, not only do I hear about it once, but twice. And now I would really love to get my hands on that that video for sure. But, you know, she has had tremendous staying power in the business. I can't believe that she was the person that played kind of like, you know, a really innocent little kid in Dobie Gillis.
Oh, yeah. She's retired now, though. Tuesday Weld is, you know, she's retired. She's living in her houses. One is in like Hampton, I think, in Long Island.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then the other one is a townhouse not too far from Central Park. And she's retired. She hasn't been in a movie in a while, or even a TV role.
Well, she actually comes from a very landed, almost Plymouth family type of ancestry. I looked for Weld in the Skull and Bones out of Yale. There were none there, but her people were real big in Massachusetts, and actually in politics to not too long ago, right?
Yeah, William Weld, governor of Massachusetts. Yeah, the Welds are traditionally a Harvard family, and they were big in getting Harvard rolling in the first place. So Yale is not—they're not really a Yale family. They're Harvard, and definitely a Boston Brahmin family. Her father was from, like, the black sheep of the family, and kind of a playboy, and she was from, like, a part of the family that I think the black sheep, her father was like the black sheep of the family, although later on she received an inheritance from, like, a grandmother that pretty much established her for the rest of her life, where she never really had to take any job she could get in acting. She could pick and choose what she wanted to do because she received a generous inheritance, according to the one biography that's out there called Pretty Poison.
Real quick, because we only got about 5 minutes left, I want everybody to know we've been talking with Doug Hawes. He is the author of the article about which we have been speaking, and that is The Turner Diaries, A Fascinating World of Jeffrey Dean Turner. You can purchase that if you would. The $7 he's asking is just to cover the production and the mailing, which is pretty fair. And you can obtain that by writing Doug at P.O. Box 1251, San Jose, California, 95108, 1251. And you can also, if you wish to, I guess, address a question or make a comment to Jeffrey Turner, you can do that also through that P.O. Box. Just address it to Jeffrey Dean Turner. And Doug says he doesn't get involved in that. He'll pass it along gladly. You can pay folks by Federal Reserve notes, silver and gold coin, postal money orders, and a check. And Doug will respond in kind. Now, we're like I said, about 5 minutes left. I'm going to throw it over to both you, Doug, and Adam. I don't know where you guys want to take it, but we have limitations. Thank you, Doug, also for allowing me to ask as much as I have. I appreciate it. And we've not touched upon a lot, and that's one of the reasons why people should avail themselves of this story. So I'll throw it to you guys, and which way do you want to take it until we have to bid each other adieu?
Doug, if you have any closing words, go ahead, then I'll wrap up this segment.
I do recommend this essay, this article, The Turner Diaries, because I really did try to cover all the bases with Jeff Turner's worldview, his experiences, his his claims, and it covers the entire plethora of the various claims he has made over the years. It's written in a humorous vein, because Jeff is a kind of a comical character. He's kind of a zany character who, he reminds me of the guy in the Get Smart TV series of the 60s, played by Don Adams, because he's both bumbling, but he is actually kind of like a secret agent. It's a remarkable situation. He's a bumbling guy, but he's also brilliant, and he is connected. So there is a documentary out right now called I Think We're Alone Now, and it's about, according to the promos, two super fans of the pop star Tiffany, and of course one of them is Jeff Turner, and that movie is going to be released in the United States on DVD in July of this year. It was released in Britain in April, and it might start showing up on late night cable television, and it sounds like it's going to be reviewed in Vanity Fair magazine, and The Guardian of London also might be writing a feature article about the documentary. And of course, the star of the show is actually Jeff Turner. The other super fan or stalker, as most people would see it, is not quite as interesting or fascinating as Jeff. And of course, Tiffany has a background role in the documentary, because the story is really about the private lives of these two super fans.
Well, very good, Doug. And if people want to find out more about that movie, they can go to the website. I Think I'm Alone Now, and find out more.
I Think Alone Now.
Yeah. And we're out of time, bud. So, hey, thanks for joining us. And we need to get you and Mr. Turner on together sometime.
Sounds good.